Hi everyone, this is Marsha, and I'm the director and founder of the Brooklyn Caribbean Literary Festival. I'm thrilled and elated to announce the birth and launch of our brand new podcast, CocoaPod. Consider the aromatic CocoaPod and how, after carefully ripening under the Caribbean sun, it generously offers up its rich fruit in due season. CocoaPod by BCLF aims to provide a similar delight. Each episode is a seed, a nugget of an original Caribbean story told in the voice of its writer. Each story, an infinite gift by the offshoot of an ancient griot tradition. As a whole, Caribbean stories are like a mighty tree whose branches extend, offering shade and comfort wherever her children settle. From my team and the legion of Caribbean writers behind us, we bring to you the warmest of welcomes.
The Coming of Og by John Robert Lee for Roderick Walcott. The Prologue. After midnight mass, Papa's yard would be bright with lanterns and flambeaux and warmed by the blazing fire over which a huge pot of meat was stewing. The women with their many-colored madras worn like crowns would be busy loading the table in the middle of the front room of the house with bottles of sorrel and ginger beer and rum and whiskey. At this time of year, no self-respecting family was without plenty for neighbors and visitors. As for the children, they would be out of bed and in the way of everyone. The musicians would be settling themselves in a corner of the house. Then, in their own good time, the chanteurs and the musicians would begin to sing the songs of the Christmas season and of the flower societies, and soon the people would begin to call out, "Vive la Rose!" because they belonged to the Society of La Rose, and they'd always been loyal to the roses. They would respond to the chanteurs' song challenges to the rival Society of La Marguerite with fervor and with joyous shouts of triumph. "Vive la Rose!" And they would dance the old dances until they were hungry. And later, they would all gather around the wooden steps that led down into the yard, and everyone would grow quieter as the violon wailed sweetly and sadly. And as they gazed into the leaping flames of the wood fire, deep within them, the music would make their hearts soft and yearning for what they couldn't say. Then Mama would call to Papa, who sat among the musicians with a shakshak on his lap. "Eh, Papa, when you was youth, you had heard your grandpapa talk about when Tijan had leave the home of his mother and go and look for his brothers and had to swim the big sea." And everyone would call to Papa, "Oui, oui, Papa, quitte l'histoire dit, let the story tell." And they would sit even nearer together. Papa would say, with a wide grin and a tremendous flourish of the long shak-shak, "Eh, messieurs, mesdames, il dit cric!" And they would shout happily into the night, "Crac!" And for the next few hours before daybreak, the old contes and songs, the stories and histories of these ancient scattered people would fill the small dirt yard. Tija and his adversaries, Compère Lapierre and his tricks, the real history of the village and its long-dead characters, familiar spirits of good and evil, they all would move among the shadows that lurked outside the edges of the protecting firelight. The children, now afraid to go to sleep, would move closer the skirts of their mothers and sisters as bolams and sukuyans and cloven-footed old men of dark forests shrieked and screeched and howled outside the hibiscus and croton hedges that encircled the yard. At another festival once, they had heard a stranger, a wandering drum maker, tell of one he called Og. He had spoken suddenly from his dark corner, and when the people expressed ignorance, no one had heard speak of Og. He had gone on to talk intensely and in a low, sharp-edged voice of this mysterious person. It was certain that everyone had to meet him someday. "Ah, Og, c'est Basil," someone said confidently. "It's Basil." "No, it's not Basil, it's not l'amour, it's not death. But a man can die when he meets Og. Man, woman, or child can see Og. May no one else see him but you. When a man meet Og, that man can die or he can disappear. Og does make a man change. Some get better, some get worse. No, Og not God or the savior of the devil. But Og can appear a beast. Og can be creature. Or Og can be human being. Monsieur Kapale Betis, it's stupid as you're talking. Listen, the stranger ignored the interruption. Og can live around a man all his life. Og can be part of your living. You, all your life, see this other person. A person as far as you know him, with a life, a family, a job, tut bagay, everything. But one day, you will discover that it's only you ever know this person. One day you will know. You will not guess. You will know this is Og, appearing in front of you, and you will never be the same. The people were silent. The night was full of the snapping fire, the cracking wood, the smell of stewed meat, the insistent cacophony of all the insect sounds, and the far-off barking, barking, ceaseless barking of someone's dog. The people wanted to be nearer to each other, but Og stood between them. Finally, a voice said, a little too loudly, "Monsieur Tambou, Mr. Drummaker, peut-être c'est où qui c'est Og là? Maybe it is you who is Og?" The people laughed. Several comments were heard. Papa called a stranger to come and get some rum and some more meat. The short, fat, red-skinned man came forward into the light, fixing his hat onto his head and looking slyly at everyone with his large, protruding eyes. Then everyone wanted something to eat or drink, and soon they were beginning to leave for their nearby homes as the dark night slowly began to turn purple and dawn lit the tops of the humped hills. They never saw that stranger again, but the new spirit of Og had arisen out of their hearts to take his place among the other heroes of this dispersion. Who was he? No one could say exactly, but the mystery of him made young and old a little more thoughtful in their lives. Each man who heard the story of Og knew it was truth. A great private question was answered that had brooded unasked in his spirit. He began to look for the coming of Og. He understood better now the strangeness that had come upon many of them for many generations. God, the Savior, the Devil, and Death were known and respected. But Og, who really was he? An answer out of a dark abyss, at the bottom of which growled and snarled the unknown statement of their deepest troublings. So familiar, and yet so mysterious. Mysterious as he was, or perhaps because his mystery was his power, he established a firm rule over the festival fires and the moonlit yards and the wakes for the dead. Tisson closed the door of the apartment quietly. He stood on the third-story veranda looking up at the stars. Over the roofs opposite, he could see the lights of ships and small yachts in the harbour. He watched a lighthouse beam flash regularly into the distant clouds. It was about 1 o'clock. Except for the occasional car or distant barking dog or crowing rooster, it was quiet. Below, the street was deserted. Tisson felt good. Marcia was snoring softly when he slipped out. A short note to say he loved her, a kiss on the closed eyes. Yes, that was the way to treat women. Treat them good, love them good, with little gifts, little notes, little surprises. A man kept a woman under control. Yes, it was an art. He felt proud that he had taught himself well. He wasn't ready yet to go to the small, comfortable house he rented just outside the town. It was still early. He would go up to the ghetto yard a couple streets away, where there would be people and reggae music and good herb. And maybe that Rasta daughter he had been keeping his eyes on would be there. He felt in the mood for that kind of company. Tonight he felt sharp and in control. Yes, Tisson felt good. He moved quickly now, happily, down the several flights of stairs and into the street. In the cool night, he tucked himself warmly into his tight dark blue denim jeans and jacket, pulled his closed neck sweater up around his throat, drew his red beret close over his hair, trying for the Che Guevara effect. His high heels loud against the pavement gave him a feeling of power. His long, slim legs made large strides past the small, doll-like houses and the late-night bars. He tucked his hands deep into his pockets and glanced often at his smooth, dark, baby-faced handsomeness in the glass windows of the uptown stores. The yard was off a narrow alleyway, and as he turned into the alley from the main road, he was hailed by the youths who lounged along its length. He was popular here. He played the music they liked on his afternoon radio programs. The smell of herb was everywhere, and several youths approached him with their small flat tins, offering the best of Colombian or Jamaican or local weed. He walked jauntily on toward the yard, humming the music of Bob Marley's latest album that played very loudly from a nearby house. He moved with a certain ease of a popular man, smiling at everyone and greeting many by name. He turned to the right off the alleyway now, went through a high wooden gate between two houses, and passed into the large enclosed yard. Several groups and individuals were scattered around. From a huge stereo speaker, reggae dub music throbbed. Tissot bought some joints from his favorite pusher, then settled near one of the groups to smoke and listen to their conversation. It was a mixed group of Rasta men and others, and talk ranged from police brutality to the quality of the herb to the latest reggae tunes. Tissot felt warm with sympathy for their causes. He enjoyed being here with them. He enjoyed their admiration. He pulled deeply on his second joint and began to look around for the young Rasta girl. His feeling of well-being and self-satisfaction was increasing, and he began to think that he would seek out the girl, buy enough herb, and invite her up to his house. He saw her sitting by herself on a small bench, her back against the high concrete wall that encircled the yard. Her eyes were closed, hands folded in her lap. "Hail, daughter," he said, settling near her, smiling. She opened her eyes and turned slowly to look at him. "Hail, man, Mr. DJ, Irie." She smiled slowly, and he thought how truly black and beautiful she was. Dimples were deep in her cheeks. "Yes, I," he drawled, offering one of the joints, lighting it with his small lighter. "Thanks, I." She did everything slowly and deliberately. A wave of tender emotion swept over him. She was nice. She sucked on the joint appreciatively. "Some good local in the yard tonight," looking at the joint, holding in the smoke and then wreathed in smoke. "Praise Jah." "Praise Jah, daughter," leaning back against the wall, climbing with the herb to move in glowing warm fantasies and visions with her beautiful at the center. He glanced through the sweet smoke at her face, strong, dark and beautiful under a red, gold and green tam, and began to think of how he could speak the invitation to his house. From where he sat, he could see her strong thighs and firm good legs thrust out from the bench, and he wanted very much to stroke their black, strong beauty. She passed her joint to him, and he could see her young, firm breasts move freely under her bodice. Tissot began to talk about how he didn't like this Babylon city, and in fact, did she know that he was from the country? He only came in to get the white man's schooling, and because he didn't like the shit stem, that was why he lived outside the shitty, where it was like the country. Yes, he was roots. He described his fruit trees and told her about the ital vegetables growing in the kitchen garden of his landlady, and how quiet and cool it was up there, and how he enjoyed living by himself where he could smoke and meditate and read his Bible in private without anybody to disturb him. She must come and visit his yard sometime. "Yes, I," she agreed. "She must do that sometime." "Yes, I. Some herbs, some ital, some music. That is all the I needed to praise Jah and live in unity and peace and love. Yes, I. Praise Jah." She rolled some herb of her own, and as they smoked again, him feeling most irie now and speaking with great enthusiasm and joy, he said, as if suddenly inspired, "Look, it's still early. Why didn't they take a walk and go up to his house now? It wasn't far. He had his stereo, some tapes with his best patois programs, plus Bob's latest LP. Also, he had ital food. They could cook a jot, and they could get some more herb. He had a dunza, so if she wanted, they could go up now." She turned to him. Slow. She looked directly into his eyes, red now and heavy-lidded from the herb. He suddenly felt uncomfortable and terribly exposed. At the same time, he became very aware of a group of bareheaded Rasta men standing silently near them. And when she laughed, her teeth white in her dark face, he was certain she was mocking him. "Another time, Mr. DJ man, not this night." Too quickly, he stammered something about it being all right. It was cool, cool, no dig nothing. And when one of the young Rasta men, hair long and thick around his head and shoulders, came up to speak to her, ignoring him completely, he began to feel threatened. When she moved off with the Rasta man, not saying anything to him again, Tissot felt as if the whole yard knew what had happened between him and the girl. He sat by himself for a while, everything now falling rapidly into confusion, the heavy bass of the nearby music now unbearably loud, and him whirling in his head, feeling hurt, rejected, vexed with himself. He didn't want to smoke again, but he tried to keep a cool front and dragged on the joint in his slow, superior manner. Tissot left the yard when he felt enough time had passed. As he went by a group outside the gate, they laughed, and he was sure they were laughing at him. The alleyway was deserted now, except for the pushers watching everyone carefully who entered or left the yard. No one hailed him now. He put his head down and walked quickly towards the main road. All his well-being was gone. The happy high had left him, and he began to feel more and more afraid. It was the nameless fear of a bad trip. He recognized it. It seemed now as if everything he heard and saw was against him. Snippets of conversation seemed to be aimed at him. Signs all seemed to carry a message especially for him. Words leaped up from scraps of newspaper at his feet. Judgment was all around. A cold sweat broke out over his body. His heart began to miss beats. The scene with the girl gnawed at his mind and was at the center of his confused emotions. He tried achingly to find his way back to the earlier calm. Should he go back to Marcia's? He stopped on the sidewalk, feeling a great indecision. No, he only wanted to get home now. His home was safe and he could sleep off this bad high. Tissot took the road on the outskirts of town that would lead him directly home. It was a dark road with street lamps at long intervals, not used much at this time of night. He was the only person on it now. But it was the shortest way home. He began to move quickly. He tried to focus his mind on something definite. He tried to go over his conversation with the girl, rationalizing that it wasn't as much of a rejection as he had at first imagined, that no one had really heard them, and furthermore, he was only inviting her to listen to some programs. He saw her legs again, thrust out from the bench, smooth, firm and dark. He began to walk more briskly. Her laughter and her abrupt departure left him empty within, hurt and ashamed. His mind felt like a deep hole into which everything was falling, and he couldn't fix anything at all. He couldn't concentrate on anything. The irrational fear beat its way inside his stomach. Tissot was now about halfway up the road. At the approaching bend that turned on a small bridge, it was the darkest part. After this, it was well lit all the way to his house. He wanted to be inside it. The door shut behind him. He hurried toward the bridge, anxious to be past it. He fought off the paranoia that filled his head with frightening thoughts and made him stumble. A couple of times he looked back to make sure no one was following him. He let out a sharp, involuntary squeal when he heard the sudden noise out of the darkness ahead. He felt his hair crawl across his scalp. His heart lurched painfully and he stopped. Demonic creatures of all shapes raced through his mind. The long shut doors of childhood memory were flung open, and all the ghosts of dark nights beyond firelit yards rushed out, screaming and cackling. The sound came again, more loudly, more different from anything he had ever heard. Tissot began to whimper in his throat for God. He knew he was utterly terrified. Part of his mind realized he was near the bridge, over the edge of which was a deep ravine. He broke wind. He groaned and trembled in the chill of his sweat. The girl's face and mocking laughter flashed clear before his eyes. The dreadlocks who had gone off with her was waiting with a cutlass near the bridge. That must be it. Why wasn't he more careful? He regretted with all his heart. And old women with the bodies of beasts and peeling skins chattered through his tortured consciousness. Despairingly, he turned around to run fast. But suddenly, a hand with claws that scratched his neck hard took hold of the back of his collar and dragged him down. He knew he was screaming. He could not hear himself. He felt his body pressed against the edge of the stone bridge, and then he was lifted and slammed a number of times on it until he lay terror-shocked and still. His head was over the ravine far below, and he could hear the water of the small stream flowing through it. His face was cold. His teeth chattered uncontrollably. His face was wet with tears. The hand with the claws pulled at him again, and somewhere behind it, the terrifying noise had increased. He slumped over to lie on his back, his face to the stars and to the moonlight just now edging over the tall, dark, creaking bamboo trees. Tissot saw everything from a long way off now, far through the pain and the fears and the herb that still whirled around in his head and his stomach, far through the voices and absurd scenes clear in his eyes and the jingles from his radio shows. In the whitening night, he now saw over him with a far baffling incomprehension. One of the town's well-known derelicts, Fanto, naked as night, eyes wide and unseeing, spittle foaming at the mouth, straddling him, Tisson, popular patois DJ. Fanto, slobbering and muttering incoherently, tearing at his throat with both hands, and from far away but still too close, with a strange and absolute clarity, Tisson observed. In Fanto's face, a horrible fullness of mad lust, fixed, no more man, beast, crazed, depraved utterly. He heard the mocking laughter of the girl again and saw her smooth black legs, and he felt Fanto's tongue obscenely slaking his mouth. And he saw Marcia's face, eager, mouth open, eyes shut, laboring. And his whole soul and mind and body revolted and drew themselves together inside of him for one almighty puke, but he could not move. And he felt Fanto tighten his legs around him all the time, chattering through his dribbling, toothless mouth. And he saw the dimpled backside of Joan the pilot's wife, and heard the giggling of Margaret the high school student, and his mouth and nose and eyes and ears were filled with the stench and stink and slobbering and panting and wheezing of Fanto. And Tisson remembered himself. And he screamed down through his soul for the horror of himself. And when Fanto stretched frantically along his body and began to flail on him with his head and arms and legs and belly, Tisson left it all far away and tried to die, but he couldn't. And he realized at last that he had met his org. Papa sat looking through the window into the yard, while Mama busied herself with breakfast. Papa watched his son pause over the fork he was pressing down with his foot into the small kitchen garden and look up to the great mountain La Saussure, whose top was covered with mist today. The young man's locks were almost down to his shoulders now, as Mama stopped for a moment by her husband to look up at her son. She sighed again as she had so many times in the past month. "But why did the boy have to do that to himself? Well, Papa, tell me. We sacrificed to give him a good schooling in town. He get a good job in town on the radio. Everybody know him, and he turning it to turn Rasta and come back here to say he dig in garden." She sucked her teeth hard in annoyance. "Eh, Papa? And you wouldn't speak to him? Make him stop that stupidness? Everybody saying he mad is something they do him, an intelligent boy like that?" Papa poured himself some water from the clay goblet. He drank deeply before he spoke. "Mama, I tell you already, the boy not mad. Leave the boy." He looked up to where his son was turning the earth again. "Is so it is when a man knowing himself, not all rich man the same way." He leaned on the window and looked up to the top of the mountain. "Some never reach. Some never reach." Mama stopped her teeth again and returned to the kitchen muttering. One of the children ran into the house crying, and Papa lifted her up. "Okay, Dudu, what happened, eh?" "Papa, Papa, brother say that if I don't go away from him and the others, he will call Og for me. I just want to play with them, but I'm afraid of Og, Papa."
"Hush, Dudu, hush. Og won't take you, hush."
Papa looked out to where his son had just pushed the fork firmly to the ground and had flung his green shirt over his shoulder. He came to the window and told Papa that he was going up to the hill. Papa watched him stride away on his long legs. The child called out, "Rasta, Tisson, you're not afraid Og take you when you go in the hills?" The young man did not turn around. Papa said, "Hush, child, hush." Papa thought, "My son meet Og already. Maybe now he going to meet God." He held the child in his arms as Mama came out with a saucepan in her hand to stand by him. And they watched their son Tisson move slowly down the path, go through the gate in the hibiscus hedge, the flowers bright red in the early light, and move toward the hills.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please take a moment to follow CocoaPod and turn on your notifications so that you don't miss new stories when they drop. One last thing. Caribbean stories and Caribbean writers need our help. Show your support by sharing and downloading this podcast as far and as widely as you can. Buy their books, support independent bookshops, and request Caribbean titles from your local libraries. Remember that a rising tide lifts all ships. Give thanks. For more Caribbean storytelling goodness, follow CocoaPod and BCLF Always Lit on all major podcast platforms.